You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
It's simply wicked people getting together, youngsters, for obscene orgies and for pushing dope. Dope has always been mixed up with Satanism and witchcraft from the very beginning, from the earliest times, and that sort of thing. But it's nothing to do with the occult at all. They couldn't harm a rabbit.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Drugs as weapons against us, Nazis running CIA drugs in South America, and did the CIA kill the Rolling Stones founder, Brian Jones? Yes, last summer we looked at the death of rock star Jim Morrison, last week guitarist Jimi Hendrix, and this week we look at the unexplained drowning of Rolling Stones founding guitarist Brian Jones. Drugs as weapons against the people. CIA's MKUltra program and the FBI's COINTELPRO was doing this in the 1960s and 1970s, according to the author of Drugs as Weapons Against Us by John Potash. Also, David Cameron wants to bring in laws to curb extremism, as we were hearing in the first hour and last week, stating that you might not have to be breaking the law to fall foul of the anti-extremism orders. But is this the very essence of Orwell's thought crime? Who's going to decide which ideas are extremists and which ones aren't? Also, apparent wreckage from MH370, the Malaysian airliner, that disappeared on its way to Beijing last year. So why is the wreckage going straight to a NATO and not a neutral country to be examined? Also, the second Malaysian airliner, MH17, downed in Ukraine. Why won't the Russians sign up to a UN inquiry? But before all that, I'm joined on the line by retired Colonel John Banks, who's been around the world in the army and now speaking out about Syria and Ukraine, amongst other things. Hi, John. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, Tony.
First, can you tell us a little bit about your background? How did you first, and when did you first join the army?
Many years ago, 1962, I joined the Parachute Regiment, went to Pathfinders, then went on to work with Her Majesty's Government in various other areas, and the old special branch in SO-15. Was headhunted by the Americans and went across to the States and worked with one of their agencies in Honduras, also in a few countries in Africa. Then went to DEA, where I operated mainly against the people I've been working with in the CIA.
That's interesting. That's the Drug Enforcement Agency. Tell us about the counterpoint between those two organisations, because it must have been really interesting having been on both sides of that.
Well, the reason I left the agency was because of the narcotic smuggling that was going on with Ollie North down in Honduras. Also, the heroin that was coming in via Afghanistan on the swaps for the Stinger and the Red Eyes and American weapons going to the Mujahideen, heroin was coming back the other way. I resigned and went to DEA and was stationed in New York for travelling the world. There is an article in Whiteout, CIA Drugs in the Press, by Alexander Coburn references, and I just couldn't, you know. Operations are one thing, but massive drug smuggling is another, and it's still going on today. There's absolutely no doubts about it.
Now, you mentioned Oliver North there. He was pardoned, wasn't he, by George Bush Sr. But what did you learn about his operations, and what was the purpose of them? And, you know, that must have been quite interesting to get to know.
Basically, They were bringing in major amounts of... Congress and the Senate had stopped all funding for the Contras. Then we had the Bekaa Valley hostage release situation, where Oliver North was involved in that and shipping weapons to Iran, breaking sanctions with George Bush's permission. But the cocaine was coming in. The agency set up crack laboratories in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York, and were literally flooding the streets with cocaine, crack cocaine. The money then was supposedly going back to the Contras. How much it ended up in private pockets, we don't know, but it was supposedly going back to the Contras. North had very strong ties with Gacha and another senior cartel member called the Cowboy, was nicknamed the Cowboy, the Mexican. And it was a major drug smuggling operation run by the US government for black money for black operations.
Yeah, but you see, what you're painting here is a picture of one arm of the US government not knowing what the other arm of the US government is doing. Because one arm's doing this drug running on an enormous scale, and the other arm is trying to prosecute it.
Well, it wasn't trying to prosecute it, it was trying to prevent it. And when eventually they did bring indictments against various people, none of the agency people, Oliver North, walked clear and free because of pardons from George Bush. If you look carefully at a name called Mansour al-Qassar, he was a Syrian, was involved with George Bush and also Oliver North regarding the Bekaa Valley, and also assisting on getting weapons into Iran for the Bush and North conglomerate.
So how close were you actually to the drugs themselves? Were you actually flying these drugs? Were you guarding them or what?
I wasn't flying them. I actually found out about it one day on a landing strip where a C-130 came in and trucks pulled up and started loading bales on it. And I said to Colonel North, excuse me, what's in the bales? And he said, oh, it's medical supplies. And I said, can anyone tell me why medical supplies are being shipped back to the to America from a combat zone? And they just laughed. So I pulled my knife and went across, slashed the bundle, and there was cocaine.
So where was this and when? What roughly, what year and which country?
This was mid-80s, about 85, 86.
And in which country, John?
Honduras.
So that must have had a pretty powerful effect on you. What did you do then?
Didn't say too much there and then because I wouldn't have left the area, but that night left, went across to an airport, got a flight out, and ended up back in Washington, D.C., where I made a full report. Resigned from the agency and joined DEA.
And so the DEA were trying to prevent it, but they didn't really manage to do that, did they?
They weren't getting the backup to do it. It was exactly the same if you ever read the Clinton or watch the Clinton Chronicles on regarding MENA Airport, where DEA agents were ordered to back off and go away from there. This was during Clinton's term as governor of Arkansas.
So what was happening at MENA Air Base then? Because, like you say,
well,
Bill Clinton, wasn't it?
It was a private airport, small one in Arkansas, where flights were coming in delivering cocaine. Federal agents attempted to get it prevented and were ordered to stay away by Washington. The Attorney General of Arkansas had to leave Arkansas. She was a female because literally they were trying to arrest her in Arkansas and shut her up because she was running an investigation into it with state troopers and state investigators. But once again, that was Barry Seal was the main runner in there. So the whole thing was once again multiple consignments of narcotics of cocaine coming into MENA and being distributed out.
I mean, if it's not a proper US military airbase, surely anybody could see that the drug running operation was going on. I mean, this is just an ordinary airstrip.
They could see planes landing, certainly, and they could see cargoes being unloaded, but they couldn't get into the airport.
Who was this guy Barry Seal then? Because I've heard about him before. If you can just give us a bit of his background.
A hired pilot flying cocaine into the US.
And so was he just a sort of freelance agent, or who was he working for?
He was a contractor for the CIA.
Look, you're painting a picture here of these intelligence services, which are part of the government, being the world's biggest drug runners, John.
CIA are the world's biggest drug dealers.
And are you saying that the British don't get involved in this? We keep our hands clean?
No, I'm not saying that in the slightest. British are doing any smuggling of narcotics because I don't know anything about the British part of it. All I know is they certainly know it's the agency is involved in it, or MI6 certainly know the agency is involved in it. They certainly do absolutely nothing to stop it. Yeah. The 180 kilograms that was arrested at Heathrow Airport 2009 was part of an operation, 180 kilograms of heroin and a further 80 kilograms seized in Kent. That was part of a CIA operation in conjunction with ISI agents.
So that's the Pakistani secret, is it?
Which secret service is that?
Yeah, okay. You've had a really interesting experience in these various outfits. Just run through some of the different... I mean, you've already mentioned the Central Intelligence Agency. We've mentioned briefly bits of the British Army and the Drug Enforcement Agency. Who have you actually been working for over the years?
Over the years? Well, my last and probably most enlightening experience was with the Directorate of Special Operations in South Africa, which lasted from 1993 up until 2009. DSO was a unit that was formed by Nelson Mandela on his release from prison. It was part of the National Prosecuting Authority, nothing to do with the South African Police Service whatsoever, in fact at loggerheads with the South African Police Service. It was an intelligence gathering unit responsible only to the President and the Minister of Safety and Security. And one thing our unit didn't like was interference from outside agencies, i.e. the Americans, the British, French, anyone. We would liaise with them where it concerned the things in their areas of interest, but we didn't like the interference from them. Operations were conducted against terrorist groups operating and seeking sanctuary in South Africa. But it must be remembered that the ANC was favourable to some of these groups simply because during the days of apartheid, when the British and Americans and the French and everyone had deserted the ANC, to go with apartheid, they were supported by some of the radical Muslim groups. So they had to return the favour to a degree. They would not allow operations to be carried out on their areas, but they would allow political discussions or anything else.
You said it was particularly enlightening working in South Africa. Why was that?
To watch the machinations of the various agencies all competing with each other. South Africa's a very strategic location. It's on the Horn of Africa. It's where the Atlantic joins the Indian Ocean, so it's strategic in that thing. It's the most stable country in Africa. Therefore, it's a good jumping-off point to other areas. It's very interesting watching everybody playing their games.
So what did it teach you then about your understanding now you're retired, of how the world really works?
Well, Tony, you hit quite a few strong points here. The war on terror, you've also said things about the war on terror. The war on terror is a sham, and the war on drugs is a sham. the War on Terror in, what, 5-6 years ago, I said to someone that al-Baghdadi was the leader of ISIS, was a CIA operative, or was released from Camp Booker and was then sent to Israel via a ability. He was flown up to Erbil by helicopter and in a Black Ops plane flew down to Tel Aviv where he was trained. Returned back into Syria over the Golan Heights, where it joins up, where Israel's got the occupied part. Al-Baghdadi was, and I would imagine is still, a CIA asset, absolutely no doubt. The funding, the weapons, the recruits being Saudi criminals from released from prison. He is there. He was there initially to stop Assad, to take on Syria. Syria is a thorn in America's side, it's a thorn in Israel's side, it's a thorn in Saudi Arabia's side, and they wanted it taken out. Everybody was saying they couldn't go to open war, so they were bringing in ISIS and other groups to destabilize and overthrow Syria. The problem was it got totally out of hand. But it's created a war on terror. The war on terror is the biggest money earner in the world today. It's overtaken narcotics for its money earning capabilities.
So who's it making money for?
Sorry?
Who's it making money for?
There are 2,700 and something private contractor companies within the United States on contract to NSA and the CIA. There are other agencies, other people who own agencies that are involved with the government. It is earning absolute fortunes, the war on terror. It's also enabling the total clampdown on everybody and our personal rights, our personal freedoms have all gone out the window, as easy as that. I mean, every time I fly into the States now, where my family are at the moment, I'm held for 11, 12 hours at immigration. They have to let me through. I've done nothing wrong. But I'm held. That's my personal freedoms have gone.
So, I mean, most of us, we just recently had a general election here. We've elected a new government. I mean, surely these are the people who are actually holding the purse strings. And that's what's important, is the government is spending our taxpayers' money on various things. And the politicians we're electing to do that for us.
Well, put it this way, Tony. Did we elect them? I mean, they only got 33% of the votes. Was that a representation of the British way of thinking? You know, the politicians forget one thing. They are voted in by the public. They are paid by the public to do what is best in the public's interest. Otherwise, like any other employee, they can be sacked, voted out. But it's now becoming a situation where once they're in, they immediately forget what they're in for. It's a club now, a money-earning club. There's no doubts about it. If we take Blair, just Blair, for example, during his tenure as Prime Minister, he stopped the Al Jumeirah bribe scandal with BAE. He was implicated in bribes with BAE into South Africa on the arms scandal there, and into Tanzania, and into Botswana. BAE sold Tanzania and Botswana military takeoff and landing radar for their aircraft, but Botswana and Tanzania do not have air forces, military air forces. But Blair had overseen the deals. He ordered the Cirrus Ford agency in England to stop all investigations into the BAE scandals.
So
So yeah, we have prime ministers who are working to their own agendas rather than what's in the interests of the public.
When you were down, I mean, one of the things we've discussed is the murky shenanigans behind the disappearance of the South African nuclear weapons after black majority rule came in. I just wondered if you've got any take on what happened to those, having worked down in South Africa.
A lot of the technology went to Pakistan. Those gentlemen worked for the South African Reserve Bank's bank, the equivalent of their federal bank. John J. Hobbs was a very, very senior member who organised the deal between Pakistan and Palabora nuclear research facility, where a lot of the things went from. In the closing days of apartheid South Africa, a lot of the information went out of South Africa to Pakistan.
Now, you've talked about Syria there in quite a lot of detail about how it certainly appears that the CIA is actually managing, running, supplying, etc., ISIS. But, you know, we're hearing day after day that they're actually bombing ISIS, John.
Tony, they're bombing. The Turks are bombing the PKK and missing ISIS. Weapons nowadays are pinpoint. If they can... If they decided they didn't like you enough, Tony, they could pinpoint your house and drop a bomb down your chimney if you've got a chimney. There's absolutely no doubts. 90% of these airstrikes, oh yes, they do hit now and again hit ISIS, but 90% hit empty desert, empty buildings. If you look at the casualty list of ISIS in a year, in nearly 1 year of attack, the casualty list is not very high. We have convoys trundling up and down Iraqi roads and Syrian roads. Spies in the sky are watching that area every day. They could call in airstrikes with no problems whatsoever on those convoys. We have the town of Mosul with a luxury hotel now belonging to ISIS, where all the ISIS commanders are on a regular basis, and ISIS guests are there. Why don't the airstrike the hotel? Why don't they airstrike the barracks or the tank compounds or where the weapon arsenals are? It's a farce. It's costing the US government $470 million a day. I don't know what it's costing the British government, because officially we're not striking into Syria, although that's just come out that we are, with embedded pilots. It is a farce. It's for people with brains to look into it and say what is happening. You realise that there is no concerted effort against ISIS. There's a concerted effort to remove Assad, and they're very sorry every time one of their missiles misses ISIS and hits the Syrian Arab army. But it's crazy.
Also, I mean, there's two major ways that ISIS are getting finance, and I mean, let's just leave aside whether you can close their bank accounts down, I mean, which would seem to me to be rather a simple thing to do, but I mean, they're getting money from drug running, they're also getting money from selling oil. Wouldn't it be fairly simple to close that operation down?
It'd be very simple to close the operation down. Put it this way, Tony, if a super tanker loads up in one of the ports in Iraq, it's spotted by in the control of ISIS. It's spotted by satellites, obviously, because they're zooming over that area all the time. So why doesn't the US Navy arrest it when it puts to sea? Why? Where? How are the people who are buying the oil paying for the oil? They don't airdrop crates with $100 bills in them. It has to go into a bank account. You know, follow the money. The old story in any kind of terrorism or narcotics, follow the money. It can't be hard to do. We're talking millions and millions of dollars per day.
Well, we had Scott Bennett on here from the United States, who'd been doing exactly that, and then was put in jail on trumped-up charges because he discovered that this money was being funneled through Swiss bank accounts, UBS Bank in Switzerland. But anyway, let's just move...
Have you looked at the last year? There were 68 suicides of very senior bankers. In fact, a group of us started to call them the swingers, jumpers and shooters. Jumping off the top of high-rise bank buildings, hanging themselves in their garages or in their houses. One guy shoots his dog, his kids, and then himself. One guy runs down an embankment and jumps in front of a train. They picked extremely painful ways of killing themselves. But 68 in a period, I think it was 9 months.
So what are you saying there? You think that maybe these people have been bumped off?
I would say they've been, you know, they knew too much for their own good, put it that way.
What about Ukraine? Because this is where the focus shifted northwards after the British Parliament 2 summers ago blocked the open assault on Syria. What do you make of what's transpired there? Because there was allegations, anyway, last February that what happened in the Maidan Square was effectively a kind of coup.
It was a coup d'etat, absolutely no doubts about it. It had every ingredient for calling it a coup d'etat. Blackwater was involved, and well, not Blackwater in its current name, or in its current name of Aegis, were involved, absolutely no doubts. The sniping was done by highly trained snipers on the Maidan Square affair. McCain's down there just prior to the Maidan affair. Victoria Nuland is telling the EU it can, if the EU doesn't like it, it can, you know, she used...
Go away, yes, away. She said in uncertain terms, yeah.
it was a coup d'etat, absolutely no doubts about it, and Russia has every right. I think Russia's been, I'm not a pro-Russia man, but I believe Russia has been extremely... restrained, and Putin's been very restrained, for a simple fact, when the USSR folded up, there was an agreement, no NATO weaponry in the bordering states of Russia. Now, America's pouring them into Poland, it's pouring them in right away around Romania, you've got the American army doing its Operation Dragoon, where it drove down the 6 bordering states of Russia on Russia.
They're also putting troops, a lot of troops, into the Baltic states, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's pure aggression. Or it's like baiting a bull. And eventually the bull's going to stick his head down and give you a butt in the bum, so to speak.
What are your thoughts about allegations that the Russians have actually made most of the running in Novorossiya, in Donetsk,
around
there?
No, I don't believe it. I do not believe it. We've got... The people in Donetsk and around that area are East Ukrainians. They speak Russian. They've got more linkage to the Russians than to the Ukrainians. But I do not think the Russians put troops in the slightest. I do not think they shot down MH17. There's too many eyewitnesses who say they saw the Sukhorov plane literally buzzing the airliner. And it's also very funny that the airliner was ordered to drop 10,000 feet minutes before it was attacked.
So what's going on here? You think it's the NATO being quite aggressive then?
I think NATO's being very aggressive, and I think it needs to stop and back away now, because America's in 174 countries in the world, and it's in another 27 countries on top of that 174 with special forces doing black operations. It's heading... America has encircled Russia, basically. They said that the missile shield was to stop Iran launching missiles into Europe. Why would Iran want to launch missiles into Europe? I don't know. But So Russia has now challenged, okay, Iran is not going to do anything else. You need to take your missiles out. And the Americans are saying no.
What about other sentiments within the British forces about this? Because, I mean, surely, I mean, particularly after the lies to do with weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, the armed forces in Britain, the British Army, the Navy, the Air Force, are surely a little bit hesitant about whether to trust the politicians the next time, aren't they?
The senior ranks may be hesitant to trust the politicians. The junior ranks, they're there to do a job, and they'll do the job regardless. You'll get a few with a common conscience who will say, no, this is wrong. But the average feelings I get amongst people who are still in the army that I know is they see through it as a mockery, but there's not a lot they can do about it.
Doesn't that affect morale, your actual fighting ability?
It does, yes. Until somebody turns around and actually proves in black and white the fruitlessness of this and deception of this, then they'll go where they're told to go.
Well, I mean, surely the fruitlessness...
They won't refuse to go into battle because that's obviously a criminal offence.
Isn't the fruitlessness caused by the problems back at home? Say, for example, massive cutbacks in the welfare bill, this sort of thing, and disabled people not being looked after anymore so well.
Well, I don't think soldiers really think of that sort of thing. They notice cutbacks when it starts to affect their equipment, when it starts to affect their combat pay, when it starts to affect their medical treatment. If they're wounded or injured, then they start to think, well, this is not right. We're fighting and we're not getting looked after. Which you're beginning to hear from a few of the vets who have come back pretty messed up from various wars like Iraq. And they're not getting the treatment they should get.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers pointing at the microphone here. I think he wants to get a word in. Martin.
Hi there. I've listened to everything you've been saying, and in actual fact, the sort of things you've been saying are the kind of things that we've been covering on this show for years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing you've said which is in any way shocking to us or to most of our audience. The question I'm really asking you is, what you said earlier, that if you refuse to go into battle, you'd be breaking the law or whatever. But what we're dealing with here is high-level criminality right to the top in the Western setup. And you, of course, have, from personal experience, have outlined various aspects of that criminality. Now, I would argue that the role of the police and the military in those circumstances is to have a plan to deal with the criminals that are carrying out these criminal acts. Otherwise, somebody else will start making a plan, and then you've got the potential terrorist opposition emerging from the criminality of those in charge.
Well, I agree 100% with you, Martin, but it's not the military's job to police politicians. It's the police's job to police politicians. They're not above the law. Blair, forget the war criminal bit, which he obviously is a war criminal. She took us into Iraq without the right legal procedures. But he's corrupt. And what I mentioned about the BAE, BAE was paying one of the Saudi princes, Prince Salman, I think it was, $30 million a year. For a bribe, because the Saudis gave us the biggest fighter jet contract ever. So we were bribing like heck, and when the police got involved on the investigation, they were told leave it alone by Blair. Now, Prime Minister should not be allowed to interfere with the lawful investigation by the police services.
That should be the principle. I mean, in Italy, Imposimato, who's the head of the Supreme Court, has pointed the finger at NATO intelligence services for carrying out various terrorist activities in Italy in the 70s and 80s.
Gladio.
Gladio, indeed. Now, we on this show obviously are trying to educate the public about all of this, and I still suggest that the only way forward is for the police to step up, the civilian police, to step up to the mark and do the job. And then, of course, they can call upon the support of the military if they need it.
Yeah, to enforce the law, yes. But, I mean, what is going on in Parliament at the moment is a total disgrace. They've broken every one of their election promises. Very soon people are going to be getting bills for their National Health Service, which they're not going to be able to pay, so they're going to go bankrupt, and then the NHS is going to be seizing houses. And I mean, it sounds far-fetched, but we're going to end up on an American-style system.
Okay, final question then, John. What are we going to do about it?
I could get arrested for my answer. Well, the only thing we do is educate people, bring it forward, hit it forward.
And I think the other thing, obviously, is to back up both politicians and police when they're actually trying to pursue these corrupt people in power. Anyway, John Banks, you're a retired colonel, were in the British Army for many years. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show tonight.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Fascinating chat there, Martin, with John Banks. What he was saying there links in very, very closely, doesn't it, to our other item. And I mentioned it at the top of the hour, and we had a chat about it last week as well, which is this article, Drugs as Weapons... the new book by John Potash, Drugs as Weapons Against Us. This whole business of the intelligence services getting people interested in drugs and to promote them to the population, it fuels an enormous great black economy.
It does. And then, of course, you also to the people who don't take drugs, you then get them all freaked out about the people who do take drugs. So it serves a dual purpose. And ultimately, of course, I believe in the legalization of drugs, and they should be approaching things from a rational point of view. But if you keep them illegal, especially if you're the state or a state organization like the CIA, you can make huge profits, because if you're the CIA, you're never going to be busted, so the risk is minimal, and that gives you a huge slush fund for which you can pay for your various nefarious activities. And at the same time, you can criminalize lots of young people who use the drugs, bang them up, give them over doses if you want to get rid of them, etc. It's a win-win from the point of view of the intelligence services.
Now we're going to have John Potash talking about the death of Brian Jones, who was the founding guitarist of the Rolling Stones. Let's have a listen to what he had to say about that, where he's also talking effectively about how drugs were used to undermine the anti-war movement.
The key is that it undermined the best abilities of these activists like the Students for Democratic Society and others that were fighting against the Vietnam War, were trying to stop the Vietnam War. And so by doing that, they could really make the anti-war protesters less effective. And you know, so by targeting musicians now, A.E. Hotchner was Ernest Hemingway's longtime editor, and he came out with a book called Blown Away about the Rolling Stones. In that book, he says that in 1965, the assistant deputy director of the CIA, Robert Lashbrook, was in London getting LSD into as many musicians' hands as possible. You know, he had agents trying to get musicians in London to use LSD. Okay, and so why was he doing that? And why did Hotchner also interview an agent that was part of that, you know, and find that out? And Mick Jagger's first hit of LSD came from an undercover FBI agent that came out in London Daily newspapers. The reason is, I argue, is because they were using them as role models, just like getting LeBron James to wear Nike, to get, you know, kids to wear Nikes. You know, that would make acid more popular. Now, when Brian Jones, you know, and they did that with Brian Jones, I argue, but when Brian Jones started sobering up, then they watched him more closely on what he was going to do next. They also framed Mick Jagger right after giving him his first hit of acid. So they got him under their legal thumbs, and they did the same with Jones, and they refused Jones a passport and a visa to come out of Britain to tour in when the 1968 Rolling Stones tour in America. So Jones was disconnected from the Stones at that point. Jones was the founder of the Rolling Stones, the best musician. He was good friends with Jimi Hendrix and John Lennon. He called Jimi Hendrix and John Lennon and asked them if they wanted to form a supergroup at that time, and they said yes. According to Hotchner quotes a member of the Guinness family who was close friends with Brian Jones, who said that one day Jones sent me to town to pick up a friend to bring back to his house. He tries to come back to his house, and all of a sudden there's a party at his house. He didn't know why. There wasn't supposed to be a party. He couldn't get into the driveway. And he goes around the back, and he's looking at the swimming pool, and he sees a group of people drowning a man in the swimming pool, in Brian Jones' swimming pool. And it turns out that was Brian Jones, but somebody pops out of the bushes and says, "You better get out of here and not say anything, or you'll be next." And he identifies again his family members by name. And that guy was scared to death, but that was Brian Jones. He was drowned in his own swimming pool, despite them saying he accidentally drowned in his own swimming pool. Keith Richards' quote was, he says, "We couldn't get to the bottom of it." He says, "Brian was an excellent swimmer. He's seen him swimming in waves, breakers up to here, And so it's like the JFK situation. You can't get to the bottom of it. It's all muddled, and we can't get any information on it." And so they knew something was up. They didn't know exactly what.
Interesting, isn't it? We're always hearing from people about the sort of investigations we do here, Martin. No one will ever know what happened. We hear that with things like the disappearing airliner, and also, of course, back in July 1969 with Brian Jones. A lot of even members of the Rolling Stones were saying, "Well, nothing really fits together. It doesn't look like we're ever going to know what happened."
Yeah, but I think we can sense a pattern here going back decades, and that pattern is Western intelligence services working with wealthy criminals at the top of the social hierarchy, and they seem to be pretty much responsible for virtually everything we're talking about. And in actual fact, it shouldn't be that difficult for an organisation like the IRA or the KGB to identify those concerned, and I'm sure they have.
The other thing is, of course, he's coming up with actual eyewitness statements of people that actually saw what was going on. Yeah. The guy was being deliberately drowned. All this stuff about him accidentally drowning because he was too drunk, a load of nonsense.
Well, I mean, I hear what's said there. We obviously, these are allegations, but they're plausible allegations given everything else that we know and what we've been just talking about with an ex-British Army colonel about what he knows.
Well, I spoke to John Potash earlier this week as well, because that was from a previous interview that he'd done. And the full interview is going to be on BCFM next Tuesday at noon on our dialect programme. But here's a little extract from that now. And this is where John tells us about LSD drug running and the fact that the drug was really peddled right around the Western world by the Central Intelligence Agency with the help of a lot of former Nazis down in South America.
When I found the evidence that U.S. intelligence was the largest LSD trafficker in the world in the 60s and the 1970s. In the 1970s, for example, Ronald Stark was caught in Italy and arrested with mass quantities of LSD, and it was found by an Italian governmental commission that he had LSD laboratories on several continents and that he had been working for the American Secret Services since 1960. And that's just one example of their networks. Another example is their use of Air America and other airlines to traffic opium. The CIA station chief named John Stockwell talked to me at a conference in 1990 and told me he was personally flying CIA planes with opium and heroin from the Golden Triangle area around Vietnam, and saying that part of the reason for the Vietnam War was really about controlling the opium fields, the poppy fields around the Golden Triangle area around Vietnam. He then said in public speeches and said to me that they then switched to the Golden Crescent area for growing poppy fields, which is around Afghanistan, and they increased their CIA assets over around Afghanistan, and that became the new largest area for supplying heroin around the world, and that the CIA assets were cultivating the opium for the CIA, and the CIA was then trafficking it around the world. And those are some of the ways that the U.S. intelligence is the largest trafficker in the world. Yet another way is through Operation Sunshine, having networks of Nazis, thousands of them, sent down to Latin America And this was a report in the New York Times. They admitted that there was estimates range between 5,000 and 10,000 Nazis saved down throughout Latin America. And they actually set up the cocaine trafficking networks that eventually toppled regimes, democratically elected regimes. They had one famous one was the Bolivian cocaine coup of 1980, where Joseph Mengele was down there helping out with that. Another guy named the Butcher of Leon, Klaus Barbie, was very active in that Bolivian cocaine coup. And those networks helped get cocaine around the world, but particularly into the United States, where what former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark told me was they were using those drugs to sedate and divide the masses of Americans. And he told me that in 1991 after a conference.
Well, again, the pattern is clear, isn't it? People have been using drugs for thousands of years, but the marketing of them has clearly been orchestrated by Western intelligence services at the same time, of course, as running a shock horror these people are taking drugs scenario with the general population. And it's basically divide and rule. And of course, the fundamental about illegal drug running by the intelligence services, the CIA in particular, is it gives you a massive slush fund. The reason why they had to do it with the Contras in Iran is because the Democratic Congress had explicitly forbidden the Reagan administration to support or arm the Contras. So in other words, they had to set up an illegal network to support them because they couldn't get go ahead. Same thing with the nationalist Chinese in the 1940s, where the CIA's big involvement with drugs really began. And of course, the use of Nazis, the links with Islamic terrorism, so as we heard in the first interview, the Western powers were supplying weaponry to the Mujahideen, and they were funding it with heroin, which was probably sold on the streets of Bristol. So people were being addicted to heroin in Bristol in order to defeat the Russians in Afghanistan. And all of the time, of course, being demonised as terrible drug users. Isn't it awful, even though the governments and the banks are behind it all?
It seems like there's almost like two parallel worlds going on here, with the police actually, some police anyway, doing their best to investigate these groups. And then when they actually get to the real big kingpins, they realise potentially anyway that they're working for the intelligence services.
Well, don't forget that things like the DEA in Latin America, they are supposed to go after the competition to the CIA drug dealers. So Pablo Escobar, who was eventually assassinated by US Marines in Colombia, his big crime was not dealing drugs. It was dealing drugs without dealing with the CIA first. And if you are the CIA, that really does make you the biggest beast on the block. And everybody in Mexico knows, for example, that they favour certain drug cartels in Mexico against others. So basically all the arrests by the police and the army are against certain drug cartels who are not in league with the CIA, and the ones that do business with the CIA, they're left alone.
Well, it sounds to me a little bit like this idea of drones targeting specific individuals, surgical strikes that we were hearing about just now from John Banks. Well, it's very easy, isn't it, for the United States to be targeting people who are rising up through the ranks in ISIS and who may even threaten the leadership of one of their CIA agents.
Well, the main message that everybody gets who's involved in all of this is don't mess with us. You know, we are all powerful. And, we were talking earlier about recruitment for ISIS in Syria and the extremist ideology and all the rest of it. I shouldn't think anybody listening to this show would think that they ought to go to Syria to join ISIS. What we are alleging is that ISIS is a front organisation for Western intelligence services. That's the conspiracy theory, and that's certainly not encouraging anybody to get involved with them. Stay a million miles away.
It's almost like a double reason not to get involved.
Indeed, absolutely.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, one of the organisations that should be covering all this kind of thing, but generally doesn't, is the BBC, as well as obviously the other big broadcasters like Sky, the other press. And we hear this week, Martin, Marion Jones, former Newsnight investigative editor, is saying that in the Press Gazette, which is the journalist magazine, and also that was an article I think was the day after in The Guardian, that everyone on the right side of the Savile argument has now been forced out of the BBC. That's Dominic Ponsford writing in the Press Gazette about it. He says, 3 days after finishing work on the Panorama documentary The Fake Sheikh Exposed, producer Marion Jones was told his services were no longer required on the programme. And he was one of the people that weighed in to say, well, they really should show the Jimmy Savile stuff.
Well, are we surprised? We've just been outlining the criminal conspiracies at the top of our society. The BBC, as a public service broadcaster, is potentially a vehicle for exposing the kind of things we've been talking about in this programme, but those in charge are determined that it's not going to be.
He's pointing out the next big scandal involving either senior VIP paedophiles, as they're called, or else the BBC itself. It will almost certainly not be aired on the BBC.
Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? That's why they're having their chain pulled and their cage rattled, so that they, because of course the BBC has a degree of trust in the population that if something was going on at the top, the BBC would tell them, and of course it wouldn't, for all the reasons that we've outlined.
Well, we also heard stories this week about the two airliners, both Malaysian airliners, some wreckage discovered and sent to France, which I find a little bit perplexing, because the French, of course, are rather partisan. Surely it should be some kind of neutral country, just as the investigation into MH17, the plane that came down in Ukraine, was looked into by the Dutch, who were part of NATO.
Well, in neither of those cases was no pursued in relation to lost aircraft. That should ring alarm bells on any objective observer. Why on earth isn't normal procedure being followed in the cases of these two airliners? And why in particular have the Malaysians been picked on by the criminal cartel that we've been outlining in this show? Well, the Malaysians actually are independent minded. They've sent things to the International Criminal Court for Bush and Blair to be indicted over Iraq.
They've questioned
9/11. The former president of Malaysia, Mahathir Mohamad, questioned whether 9/11 was an inside job, as many other heads of state have done, incidentally. And also, of course, the Malaysians in the 1998 currency crisis brought in currency capital controls on their banks and on movements of capital, which was against IMF policy, and they succeeded, thus demonstrating that it could be done. So there's plenty of reasons why they would be picked on to have their airline, and of course Malaysian Airlines has now gone bankrupt as a result of all the bad publicity associated
so
with these crashes.
So why do you think, in a nutshell, why haven't the Russians gone along with this UN inquiry into MH17?
Well, because the UN inquiry is not being followed by normal procedure. What they did is they got four countries together to look into this, one being Dutch, the other Kiev. Now Kiev are actually suspects, but they've had a veto on any findings.
Okay, well, we'll finish tonight with a clip from Patrick Chalmers. He's a former Reuters journalist that wrote a book called Fraudcast News.
So if you look at any of those stories from Syria, the Middle East, whether it's Greece, for example, you are getting, by and large, the groupthink coverage of the issue. Greece, let's take for an example. Greece is not only what could kindly be called a fiscal waterboarding of the Greek people. It is also told in a very narrow corridor. There are all sorts of truths that link the Greek story back to the financial crisis of 2008, the massive bailout of private multinational banks at public expense, the bailout of French and German banks at the expense of the Greek people, the idea that no one in the 28-country European Union is really getting a chance to say anything about what's going on with the imposition of austerity, which in fact, as Paul Krugman, the US economist, has said, doesn't actually work anyway, but the imposition of austerity on the Greek people. So there's a total lack of democracy, which in terms of real popular accountability for what's going on in this whole Greek story. And that lack of accountability runs through pretty much everything. And yet it's not tackled by journalists generally. Journalists generally go to the press conference with the prime minister, with the opposition, maybe the CBI, maybe they got down to an ordinary person at the bottom of the story, or perhaps a union leader. But in terms of the accountability for what these people are doing in our so-called in our name, there's no getting beneath the skin of it.
That's Patrick Chalmers there, author of Fraudcast News, former Reuters journalist, giving his perspective after many years in the profession. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights, our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesdays at noon, where this week you can hear an exclusive interview with the author of the new book, Drugs Us, Weapons Against Us, I did earlier this week with John Potash. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Councillor for Knowle, leader for the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, Gary Hopkins. Thanks also to John Banks, former colonel from the British Army there, and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and links and our archive. And you can follow my Twitter feed on between shows at Tony Gosling. I am Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Join us for the politics show at 5 o'clock next week. And don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, four people have died after a small jet crashed as it came in to land at an airport in Hampshire. The plane hit a full car park, sparking a fire which completely destroyed several vehicles. Pictures from the scene at Blackbush Airport show the shells of burnt-out cars and debris from the aircraft. Olga Venner from Hampshire Police says a full investigation is getting underway.
We've secured the scene here and we've got investigators from the Air Accident Investigation Board here, along with our own investigation officers.
David Cameron is warning the migrant crisis in Calais could last all summer. The Prime Minister is sending extra fencing and sniffer dogs after more people try to get onto trains.